Hello, my name is Richard Griffiths, and welcome to this edition of That Reminds Me. Now, I don't know about you, but one of the things that most amazed me over the years is the number of interviews where you read about some actor who is asked, quite shyly it would appear, by the journalist, when did you decide you wanted to be an actor? And they usually say something like, oh, well, you know, when I was a child, I used to play all the time in front of my mother's dressing room mirror, and I used to do little scenes and sketches and acts there, and it sort of developed. I knew then I was going to be an actor. And if you weren't born into it, that seems to be the only alternative. And I used to think, well, it never happened to me. I mean, apart from the sacrosanct front parlour in our house, you know, which was there for high days, holidays and for best, the best furnishings in our house were in, it was my mother's bedroom suite. And if I'd been caught playing in there and pretending to do stuff in front of the mirror, I'd have been skinned alive at least. The idea of being an actor never entered my head for almost two decades after I was born, so I can't ever go anywhere near that. The other thing that's peculiar about my childhood is that my parents were what is known as profoundly deaf. Alas, the common phrase is that they were deaf and dumb. The trouble with dumbness is, it works like this. If a person is profoundly deaf, they cannot hear the sounds they make themselves, let alone outside. And as a consequence of that, they can't make words, because as we speak, we monitor all the time, subconsciously, the sounds we make when we speak. And that's how we know what the words sound like and how you say them. If you're deaf, you can't hear that, then it's not possible to speak. If you look at somebody like, Jack Ashley, the MP, who went completely deaf, his speech has sort of slowly deteriorated, but in such a way, because he could remember a lot of it, people could understand what he was saying. In my parents' case, it was there from the get-go. So I was born into a household that was entirely silent. I mean, we never possessed a radio, for instance, until I was 15, and that was... I'm not going to go into that. But, you know, I think we had a telly before we had a radio, because there were pictures. So it was very strange. So I had no tradition of even speech in my upbringing, never mind anything remotely to do with the theatre. But what we did have was sign language. I learned that well before I could speak. But my dad's mastery was in telling stories, you know, and he would see, when he was working away from home, of course, he'd go to the movies. Of course, being totally deaf, he had no idea what was being said. The acid test of a good film, by the way, I think any great movie director would acknowledge, is that the narrative of the story must be carried by the images on the screen. The pictures tell the story, not the dialogue. You know, it's all right if you're doing Shakespeare, we have to have all this chat. You know, and you can carry the story. But actually, in a movie, I mean, like when King Vidor went to John Ford's house, you know, and knocked on the door and said, I've just seen a stagecoach. He said, oh, good, okay. Right, yeah, so you have made John Wayne into a movie star. Yeah, right. So, but he can't act. So how did you do that? So you better come inside. And they went in. Of course, all those Hollywood guys had little mini cinemas in their back parlours, and he threaded up the film and sat and watched the movie. And then King Vidor turned to John Ford and said, it's fantastic, but I see it, but I don't get it. And John Ford said, you know what the big secret was? Don't let him talk. If you watch Stagecoach, you will see, and I offer this to the hearing world listening now, count his lines. John Wayne speaks 14 times in the whole movie. Everything else is gunfire and killing ninjas. But so you know, I left school at 15. I had no qualifications worth a mouthful of saliva. And GCSE was something that grammar school kids did, and I wasn't one of those. And it was on Teesside, Stockland Tees, which, you know, it's a fantastic happening place nowadays. Then it was just a disaster area. And I left school at 15, and by the time I was 16 and 2 months, I still hadn't had a job. I went down, I applied for a warehouseman's assistant job once, and there was a queue around the block. I said, what are they queuing for? I said, oh, there's apparently 300 applicants today. Oh, dear. And I remember I got some money, £3, and I had a brand new pair of walking boots, and I set off for London to get a job. It took me 5 days to get there. I covered about 80 miles in 4.5 days, and then the other half day when my feet had completely broken down, you know, don't try to walk 215 miles in a new pair of hiking boots. You will lose. You know, that reminds me of, apropos of nothing at all, there's a lovely line of Calvin Coolidge, one of the dullest presidents there ever was, who's certainly one of the most taciturn, was at a presidential fundraising do in Washington, very glitzy do, and one of these socialite girls came gushing up to a young American debutante, and she said, "Oh, Mr. President, my papa says you're the most taciturn man in America. He says if I can get 3 words out of you, he's going to buy me a full-length mink coat. What do you say to that?" And Mr. Coolidge said, "You lose." And so I went to London, and by the time I got there, I mean, I should have just gone straight to the nearest casualty unit, but I remember getting to Oxford Street, and I went and I suddenly saw this thing. It said Juvenile Employment Agency, and I went in there, and I said, "Any jobs?" And he said, "Look, it's 5 to 12, we're closing now. We're back on Monday." I said, I need a job. And he had a little box in front of me. He said, "Well, I've only got about 20 or 30 here. What do you want?" I couldn't believe it. I mean, 20 jobs on Teesside. Somebody would have died in the rush, you know. I said, "Well, I want to do something in advertising. I'm very good at art. I'd like to do something in advertising, perhaps." And he said, "Photography any good?" I said, "Yeah, that'll do. That'll do. Right, authentic. There you are. You can get around there now. They're still working now. There'll be somebody wanting to see you there." I said, "Oh, fine, thanks." And I got the job. It was a messenger. Which, of course, is perfectly reasonable, you know, when I look back from this distance. But at the time, my feet had started to bleed. And they weren't going to work for about a month properly without bleeding again. So being a messenger boy wasn't the smartest way to go. But it was £7 a week. And so I jumped at it. And I vividly remember an encounter, nothing to do with my choice of being an actor, but it certainly rings a bell somewhere looking back over the years now, which is very soon after I got there, they gave me this package to deliver to the Dorchester Hotel. And I didn't know it at the time, but there's a glorious poem by John Betjeman called Christmas, in which he talks about, "And the shining ones who dwell safe in the Dorchester Hotel." And so I arrived there with these hiking boots and denims and a combat jacket and a package. And I said, "I've got a package here for, I can't remember, can you read that?" And the concierge looked down at me, you know, from the top of his nose. It felt like an alpine reach, you know. And he said, "That's the third floor, room number 324. And I said, "Oh, right, well, can you give me a receipt for this then?" He said, "You must deliver it. I haven't people here, and I'm certainly not going to do that myself. I'm far too busy. Go away." So I hobbled over to the lift, and standing there, I was all squelchy in my left foot, you know. And I thought, "Oh, please don't bleed on the carpet. Please don't bleed on the carpet." And I got up in the lift to the third floor, and I squelched down the corridor. And I got to this door, 328, and tap, tap, tap. There was a beat, and then the door opened, and there was this magnificent-looking man, gigantic, tall, slim, athletically built man. Obviously, just I dragged him out of the shower or something. He put a wrap on, this fabulous sort of silken Chinese, I don't know. It was just, to me, a picture of health, wealth, and happiness. And I'm standing there, feeling like I wouldn't even go into that. And I proffered up the parcel, you know. I said, "Parcel for three," and petered out. I just went to nothing. I actually went to white in the head. I went to pieces. I recognized who it was. It was the actor Gregory Peck. And everything just vanished from my thought. I thought, "It's Gregory. I've just seen you kill the white whale." And I see your foot's better. I wish mine was. And it's here, I said, turning into instant feebleness. And he looked at me, and he had that wonderful, you know, stern look on his face. "Thank you, thank you." And he took the package, And he was clearly at a loss. I couldn't think why he was at a loss. I thought, he'd just thank you and shut the door, you know. And he said, thank you. And he fumbled around in his pocket of his dressing gown. And he produced a 10-shilling note. Now, here's a little footnote for the modern audience. I'm talking about serious money here. You know, you can take your euros, you can take your £5 that isn't the size of a bus ticket, which you have today, and you can stick it up the nearest flue, as far as I'm concerned. A 10-shilling note in Her Majesty's money in 1963 was a serious piece of business. And not only was it a beautiful note, but it was a big thing, and it bought loads of stuff. 4/5 of a bottle of whiskey, for instance, you know. A 10-shilling note, he proffered this 10-shilling note, and he said, do you have change for this? And I just thought, no, I didn't want a tip. I was so breathtaking at seeing him, and it was such a glorious experience. Money would have just written, and I said, no, please, no, I don't want it. I don't, no, I haven't any change. No, but I don't want it. No, thank you. I'll go now. He said, no. Take it. Just take it. Well, I don't want, boom, the door shut. And now I've got Gregory Peck's 10-shilling note. I wrapped that up, then I went down and got an envelope from the deck, put it inside that. But that was my mad money now, you know. That was the Gregory Peck 10-shilling note. And it was a fabulous encounter. About a week later, when I was taking a shower in the place I was staying at, somebody went through my bag and took the money. And so that was the end of the money. But I got over that, you always do. But I did have that glorious golden memory, and it was like something out of a movie. And, you know, that was, 40 years ago now, that memory. And I have never once seen its like, with the possible exception when I did a picture called Withnail and I, and I had a gown that nearly matched his. but that's a rather sordid story, so I better move swiftly over that. I came running back from London eventually. I couldn't handle it at all. I was too young, too stupid, not doing the right stuff. And I ended up, for my sins, at Stockton Billingham Technical College, trying to throw a lifeline into the future, which, in fact, please the Lord, it sort of did for me. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. And the reason I'm an actor is I couldn't do maths. You had to fill out choices of subjects to make up your course to be a full-time student at a technical college. I was trying to get O-levels. And in the last column, it said maths and drama, and I loathed maths and always thought I was rubbish at it. So I said, I'll do drama. And that's kind of how this all got started. And I remember my first time on stage, very first play I was involved in was Arthur Miller's The Crucible. And I was playing officially Giles Corey. And we started workshopping it in the second term, and then we were going to do it in the final term. And by the end of the second term, after, it can only have been 12 weeks' work, I still didn't know the words, and there was less than 3 months to go. And we came back from the holidays, and it was announced to me that the guy playing the leading role had been rushed to hospital. And in the theatre, Richard, there's a thing called an understudy, and you're it. And I still hadn't learned the 20 lines of Giles Corey. I mean, Danforth has twice that on the first page, you know. And my heart sank. But I can't, thank you. And I never quite learned the lines. I mean, it was shambolic. It was hardly the word. And I remember we only played for 3 nights. Thank God. And I think Arthur Miller was most grateful for that. And there was a little bit of dialogue in it, which was a nightmare. And it was just a tiny thing. I used to go up to Judge Haythorne's desk. It all takes place in this anteroom, which means you don't have to use formal court setup and facilities and procedures and all of that. It's supposed to be happening accidentally in the room next door to the court. And all we had was these forms that had been taken out of the gymnasium, you see, and organized in a basic V shape. And at the top of the V, there was a little card table where Judge Haythorne sat with the script on the deck. Of course, the audience can't see it, so it's no problem. He just read his lines. And, envious Casca. And I went up to him and I looked at the line, and there was this little bit of dialogue, and it went, Danforth says, Mr. Proctor, and Mr. Proctor, the great tragic hero of the play, stands up And Danforth says to him, because Proctor's wife's been arrested as a witch and she's going to be put to death if that's decided upon. And he says, trying to find a way out for this poor woman, he says, "Mr. Proctor, this morning I received a statement from your wife in which she states that she's pregnant. What say you to that?" And if he's any kind of a guy at all, he'll say, "Yes, she's pregnant," because in those days, if she was pregnant, it meant she couldn't be a witch, you see. She was a proper Christian. And the charges would drop and she'd be allowed to go home. But of course, John Proctor cannot tell a lie. And he says, "I cannot tell a lie. My wife is not pregnant." And the tragedy unfolds from that very moment, you see. And so on the first night, I turned around at this point, looked at the script on the judge's desk, and turned around and looked around the room and got everybody's attention. And I said, "Mr. Paris." I thought, "Oh, no, it's the wrong name." And there was a boy called Anthony Richardson, and he was struck by this nightmare moment of having his name called out, and you know, and he didn't know what he was. "I don't have any lines at this point." And it is an actor's worst nightmare, that you're at the centre of everybody's attention. There's 1,000 people in the audience looking at you with bated breath, and you don't know what you're doing, because I'm sure that nothing was... I swear, I don't have anything to say here. Why's he called my name? I want to go home now, you know. And beside him, the people who never knew where they were anyway, but they weren't called upon to say anything except ooh and ah, were giving him rather forceful jabs, you know, saying, "Come on, get up on your feet." I said, "But I'm going to get up, get up, get up, get up. And they pushed him to his feet. And now everybody's attention is riveted to him. You see, the rest of them have said, "Tony Rich, you should have stood up there, you know. You should be holding up the show. What's the matter with you?" And he couldn't articulate what it was. The nightmare was just unfolded, got deeper and deeper. And I'm standing there feeling slightly guilty. But I'm more worried about how are we going to wriggle out of this than, you know, the fact that his brain is about to be destroyed, you know. So I said, "Mr. Paris, during the following discourse, I wish you to remain seated and make no interruption." And he said, No. Oh, no. You see, that wasn't it. What happened then was I turned round, right, to my protagonist and said, "Mr. Proctor." And he shot to his feet and said, "Yes, Mr. Danforth." And I said, "This morning I've received a statement from your wife in which she states that you are pregnant. What say you to that?" So I nearly never went on stage again. That wasn't the reason I wanted to become an actor, by the way. That put me off it. I thought, my God, if that's what actors have to go through. Not for me. Thank you very much. No tar. What I'm going to be is a painter. But of course, my generation, in droves, seem to be sitting around in atelier and studios and various, painting rainbows on twigs. I say that metaphorically. It just seemed to sort of encompass what they were doing in art. And I said, "Well, what's this?" I said, "This is art, mate." I said, "Well, I don't fancy the look of that." So I was devastated, and I threw up art, and I gave it up, and I looked around, and the only thing that was fun, and I thought that was crucial, I had experience shoveling concrete, thank you. I've experienced walking to London, thank you. I know about hard work, thank you. I didn't want to do it. So I thought, I know, drama. You have fun doing that. I'll be an actor. That was really the turning point for me. And that happened, you know, after my second decade. The first job I actually got as a professional paid Max Factor was with the BBC. I won what is now called the Carlton Hobbs Award in 1970. By various means, I ended up very rapidly at the Royal Shakespeare Company in 74. And I was the junior member of the company, so they all voted me the equity debt, which means I had to go around and collect the subs and send in reports to equity, all the dreary, boring, bureaucratic stuff, which you could only impose on the junior member of the company because nobody else wanted the fag of it all, you know. And one day, I remember Gordon Jackson, we were doing remounting a production of Macbeth at the Aldwych Theatre with Nicol Williamson and Helen Mirren playing the leads. And Gordon Jackson had come into the company to take over the role of Banquo. And we'd been working, I don't know, a few days, and he came up to me with his sub. And he gave me the money, and I was writing out the equity official receipt for him and all that. And he said, "Could I ask you a question, Richard?" I said, "Sure." He said, "I've noticed in rehearsals that an awful lot of people are doing Scottish accents." I said, yes, no, just a minute. I said, yes, yes, yes. I know what you're going to say. And on behalf of everybody, I happen to know how offensive it must be to your ear when you hear all these Sassenachs mangle the accent. But the fact is, Mr. Nunn has said that because this company is full of fantastic Scottish actors, well, there's Nicola Williamson, there's yourself, there's Malcolm Tierney, and therefore he felt it was criminal to waste the accuracy and the authenticity of the sound, and so he's insisted that we do this with everybody, as it were, it's set in Scotland, which is what the play asks for. And that's why, and I know it's made a lot of English actors completely paranoid because nobody, you know, if you are Scottish, when you hear English people try and do a Scottish accent, it just makes you grind your teeth, you know, and it gets you very, I understand that. I come from the Northeast, it's when anybody tries to do a Geordie accent, it makes me want to vomit, you know, if they can't do it. And so I understand, it must really kill your ear. I'm half Scottish myself, my mother is Scottish, you know, and I can do her accent perfectly. I didn't tell him then she couldn't speak at all, but so you know, if it offends your ear, I'm very, very sorry. I apologize for everybody, on behalf of everybody, I apologize. He said, no, you've got me completely wrong. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the thing is, you see, I've lived in London for so long now, I don't know if I could do a Scottish accent. It was a very tricky time for me. And before then, when I left the RSC, I'd started making films. My very first one was in 75. My very first appearance in front of a motion picture camera was in 1975 on a magical, absolute foundation, seminal, groundbreaking movie of the British industry called It Shouldn't Happen to a Vet. And I had actually a non-speaking role in it. I mean, it was a nice part if it hadn't been cut. And and when I arrived at Malton in Yorkshire to start work on it, I didn't realise that my first day, because I was very much the junior, my very first day on the picture was, in fact, the picture's first day. And the director, I remember, said to me, now, all you have to do is take the horse and cart and you go down this very straight road, and this is the opening of the movie, and you see this hillside, a very steep hillside, and the road zigzags down to join this road, and down there will come Mr. Alderton, because he's the vet of the title, and he's the star of the movie, and he's coming down this road. As he comes onto this, the road you're driving along, he'll pass you, and at that point we need you to look over your shoulder at the car as it's vanishing away, and you give him a really filthy look, all right? And that's it, really. And then we'll cut and move on to the next shot. Fine. And then he said, have you ever done any horse and cart work before? I said, no, I've never seen one. And he said, oh, well, you better talk to the farmer here. And he said, hello, has there had any experience with horses? I said, no. He said, oh, bugger. he said, now, this is Perce. He's a Clydesdale, he's rising four, he's only just been broken to shafts, and he's got a very soft, very delicate, very gentle mouth. I don't want you rexing it around. And you don't know how to drive him? I said, no. He said, oh, but get up on the cart, it's a big two-wheeled cart. I said, oh, what's this stuff? He said, that is horse manure, there's a ton of it. It'll think of it as a steadier. And get up there, and I was thinking, God, if I get any higher, my nose will bleed, you know. Terrifying drop down there, and this huge, huge horse. It was nearly the size of our house when I was 6 years old. And it was terrifying, and it was Perce, and he was very bright and fit and young, and he had not a clue, like me. So it was a very dangerous situation. And he said, now, you take the reins like this, and you draw them gently till you take up all the slack. Don't pull on it, he'll go back, don't do that. Balance it. He's straight. Now, just keep him straight. If you tug on gently on the right, his head will come, he'll turn to the right, and if gently on the left, he'll turn to the left, you see? So if you don't do anything like that at all, just keep it straight, he'll go straight. Fine. Have you got that? Yes, I think I can manage that. Right, so when you want him to go forward, you just flap the reins so he'll feel a gentle slap, gentle is the word, on his back. And you say, walk on, and he'll walk on. He's good as gold purse, heart of gold. They say, right, have we got that? Are you ready, Richard? Yes, thank you. Why me, Lord, why me? And that's right, action, flap, walk on. Big horse. Very fit, very young. And down the road, up the hillside, negotiating furiously, trying to get up 20 miles an hour. It's John Alderton driving with a venomous fury. Down there, I'm going to around the hill. And the music's going, da da. And Danny comes down the hill. Here's me. And he comes whizzing past me. And I look over my shoulder and I give him a filthy look and go back to the horse and then just pull on and stop him, you see. And then, cut! Why did you stop the horse? I said, well, because I thought that was... You don't stop until I say cut. Right, bring it back. So, three men had to come and back the horse up 100 yards. So we're going to do that again. And this time, when you look over your shoulder, for God's sake, stay looking over your shoulder. You just glanced. That was no good. We didn't even see it on the camera. We see the car come through the shot, and then we'll throw focus forward onto you so we can actually see your face. And at that point, that's when we need you to be scowling. And we need you to hold the scowl because the frame stays on you until I say cut. Have you got that? I said, yeah, yes, right. Well, let's do it now. So the second time, everything happened as it did before, but this time, as the car whizzed by, I turned, looked over my shoulder and scowled at him furiously and thought, die, you hun. well, not quite, but something like that. And then I completely lost my balance and fell into all this horse doing. And what had happened was that I'd been so loyal to the direction of looking over the shoulder, not realizing that because of the turn of my body, I'd actually relaxed the pressure on my left hand and purse, good as gold, ever so gently walked off the road and demolished 37 feet of dry stone wall. And so that was my introduction to filming, and I thought to myself, this is the life. Time, we're up against it with the clock. This used to happen in the old days in Hollywood. Hollywood only began because of the weather. There was a guaranteed sunshine that they could work in. They didn't have lighting like we do today. And they would go out into the countryside and they would take two rolls of film because a film camera can only hold a 10-minute reel. And most pictures were told the entire story in two reels because that's all that the projectionists could cope with in the cinemas. And it took a day. And it was all operated by hand, cranked on these reels. And at the end of the day, if everybody was happy, the director would say, that's it, folks. Let's wind, which means wind back the film, reel it, close it up, and print. So W for wind, R for reel, A for and, P for print. Nowadays, we just say, that's a wrap, folks. Go home. God bless. And thank you.